want to see hybrid form where he's like split down the middle.
We won't get that till Kamen Rider Double.
God damn it. I never get what I want.
No, you do. We just have to wait.
I never get what I want now.
Welcome to the Commentary Track, a Kamen Rider podcast. I'm your host, Jared.
I'm Cody.
And I'm producer, Jed.
How's it going?
Pretty good. I figure you'd give updates this week, bro. It's been a while. I've given lots of updates on what I've been watching, what I've been up to. I figured it's your turn.
Sure. In the last week, I think I have watched 3-4 hour plus long YouTube videos.
Like documentaries or?
Video essays. Two of them were compilations of like 10-minute long videos that were just one person going in depth on like the Space Marine Legions and then some of their successor chapters. But another one was a 4-hour and 20-minute long video essay on Cons of Tarkir Block and what it says about imperialism and things like that. If you have the time, I highly encourage watching it.
Producer's note. These are Warhammer 40K and Magic the Gathering, respectively.
Interesting. I do love artists make commentary and put it into their work. Kind of topical this week with the whole debate raging online about whether or not Starship Troopers is satire.
The book Starship Troopers, no, that is in fact very pro-fascism. But then Paul Verhoeven, when given the script, was like, absolutely not. I will not do anything to support fascism, but you know what? I'll do it as satire. And they're like, you directed RoboCop. Sure.
I love that one quote he has floating around these days. There's that one image of him when he was directing it that said, I only accepted the project with the intent to make it so undeniably satirical that the notion that some people don't get it will eternally haunt those that do. And I think about that a lot.
He succeeded.
He did. He did. I am eternally haunted. You know, a lot of the ways I look at the world these days, it's just like, how can you possibly?
The other thing that stands out for me within the last week was I heard a piece of music that I have chosen to interpret as someone having a complete psychotic breakdown and mistaking it for religious epiphany. Because if it's being genuine, it's a terrifying song.
What's the song?
Way of the Triune God. The thing about it is, as is often the case, the first time I listened to it, I completely misunderstood the lyrics. And not being super familiar with the term triune, because who uses that? I mistook it as dying. And I loved the story that was conjured in my head of this person who is like the last member of this dying faith. And refuses to, you know, let his wayward deity go down without a fight.
I love that. Kind of American God style. I didn't have too much time to think of a Will It Grong this week. Most of the stuff I could think of that we haven't covered just either felt entirely too specific or, you know, 90% sure we've already covered here and there and I've just probably forgotten about it.
I think we should take a second and rate Zajo. For supporting characters, we'll just give a rating of what we think of them, then compile our scores like normal.
Okay. Sure, we can do that.
Strictly speaking, Zajo isn't needed, and from a story point of view, he offers nothing. However, he does a lot of world building just by existing. He's a member of what we suppose is a crafting caste within the Gurungi, which exists outside the norms of their society. I think he's neat, but doesn't contribute much. 3 out of 5.
Yeah, I'd also probably have to give him a 3 out of 5. Zajo didn't feel that relevant. Like, I'm gonna stick him right in a 3 out of 5 because he just didn't do anything. He didn't give us too much extra plot. He sat there polishing stuff the whole time, and it was the biggest waste of a salamander I've ever seen. And I've seen several.
So I think I'm gonna talk through him first before I assign a number. I do agree. In the grand scheme of things, he didn't add anything particularly to the plot, but I do feel like the world is so much richer because he exists. The fact that the show leaves so much unsaid and in the manual certainly doesn't do any favors, because at no point, unless I guess you know the etymology of Zaijo for Japanese, would you ever even get salamander. No. They certainly don't say it. You never see his Gorongi form. He seems to know more than a lot of the other Gorongi, because he has passing comments about, like, what certain people are doing is stupid. We're never given any insight into it, but he's made to appear wiser than the other Gorongi. Ultimately, though, it does really add nothing. It wouldn't change without those insights, and I doubt we're going to get answers for them, especially now that he's been butchered. Yeah, I think it does end up being a bog standard 3. Like I said, he colors the world a bit more. It's interesting. It raises questions that ultimately will not be answered.
Yeah, I guess that's the question. Like, if Zaijo Rei was not in the series at all, not one single moment he appeared on screen actually happened. We cut all of it. Would it have changed anything? Would it have influenced the story in a single bit? We still have some episodes to go, so maybe there's something we're missing.
It's possible. I guess they said he made Garima's scythe. I think they state that.
She could have just had that.
Yeah, I suppose that's fair. No, I don't think it would change anything if they just had those.
Yeah.
So that seems like it's a straight 3.
Yep.
Honestly, maybe better than he deserves, but it feels right to have him dead in the middle as far as that goes.
He's the first one we're doing, so, you know, just kind of setting him as the average benchmark. Is he more or more useful or useless than Zaijo? I'll give that man 2.5 Zaijos in plot relevance.
Well, shall we go ahead and get into the episodes?
I'm so excited.
This week we are watching episodes 42 and 43. Battlefield and Reality.
Isn't this that John Travolta movie where they had the weird things on their noses?
That was Battlefield Earth.
Oh, all right.
Episodes 42 and 43 were written by Arakawa Naruhisa and directed by Kaneda Osamu. They originally aired December 3rd and 10th, 2000. A jump to the sky turns to a rider review.
I'm confused on where we're supposed to go from this episode.
Yeah, it feels a little like we're spiraling.
Bit.
I don't know. Let's go through it.
Sure. So we start on the street. Ichijo is heading towards a scene. Nozomi radios informing that, yeah, I guess this particular area has been blocked off by the ULF. People are trapped inside, and that this is the fourth attack that it's done. We've apparently missed a good amount here.
Remember, the best thing you can do in a TV show is to tell, not show. Same as we keep doing hand gestures on our podcast.
There is no possible way for us to not talk with our hands.
It's true.
Like, to get back to the episode, we're informed that Sugita and Sakurai are basically already there leading the vanguard.
Hell yeah.
And that Godai is en route as well.
Obeying the speed limit.
We get the opening credits. And after that, we cut to inside an underground shopping mall, and we see
Gobabble Da, portrayed by Sakurai Kensho. His name is derived from Buffalo. His costume was modified from Gojino Da.
Wait, the boar? They reused his... Okay, I can see it.
And they gave some bandana action to the human character. I don't like the caricature of a Native American person.
Yeah.
It's Village People-esque, almost. It's Mortal Kombat Village People.
I now have an image in my head of Nightwolf singing in the Navy.
I didn't get that until you started saying it.
It's exactly what it is, though.
It's got a bit of a hippie aesthetic to it as well.
I'm just going to stare at you until you agree with me.
Much like Jed, once you mentioned it, I can't unsee it.
Mm-hmm.
However, I don't think that was their intention.
I pick up like 70s rocker.
Come now.
I guess him being a buffalo.
He's a buffalo.
I feel
ill-equipped. The connections to the Native Americans are inescapable, as they are cartoonishly characterized.
Producer's note, I'm not sure if they're racist, or Cody's racist for assuming they're racist. But someone is definitely racist.
So he's walking through not quite a heap, but a spread of dead bodies.
A smorgasbord.
The props department had fun throwing red paint at the wall for blood splatters. And he comes up to Doldo, who's furiously abacusing.
Listen, he's killed 682 people Doldo in four attacks.
Yes, Doldo says that he has killed 682 people in four attacks, and that he has...
That's 170.5 per attack.
What's he doing?
It seems that he is trapping people inside of, I guess, underground shopping centers. Places where they no longer have an exit, and then just taking his time? Or maybe he takes out that hammer and spins in a circle.
Ah, yes. Marth style.
But yeah, he seems to be just trapping people and wantonly slaughtering them.
Yeah, because we see the exit staircase, and it's full of caved rubble and debris.
Yeah, and the police have already mentioned that the ULF is the one who is bringing this stuff down. So he's trapping people in there with him and then playing the game.
My God, this would have been a cool thing to see in an episode.
Yeah, at least we get to see the aftermath of it, you know, as opposed to just being told.
That's what I really like, is to see the aftermath of the stories I want to watch.
Yeah. Doldo says that he's got 47 left to kill, and given that he is averaging over 100 per incident, this fifth one should be a cakewalk for him.
He doesn't even have to collapse a whole subway station. He can collapse a mini mart or two and he's fine.
Yeah. Hell, like a single projection room in a movie theater could be enough.
One good arcade floor and he's golden.
Yeah. Surely nothing bad's going to happen to him and prevent him from winning what should be an easily won game.
I believe you.
I don't.
Whoops.
We cut to Ichijo driving at the end of this, and he is still racing towards. Now we cut to a building with Baruba and Godol talking, and they're discussing that Babel is almost finished his game. Godol feels the need to say that, oh, he's picked an interesting way to play the game. Maybe? Again, this kind of feels pragmatic. Like, yes, trap a bunch of people in a spot where they can't get out, and it's swatting fish in a barrel.
It's a very small barrel and of a very large mallet.
Yes. Baruba brings up the concern that Kuga could still stop this.
Which, holy shit, the first time one of them been like, hey, maybe the guy that's killed everyone we've put on a game so far could be a challenge for us.
And I think... I can't remember if Godol mentions, I know Babel does later, but this is the first time they mention again that, like, oh, he is different than the old Kuga.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they talk about it, and then Babel, Goatman, Buffalo Boy, he also mentions it.
Buffalo Babil?
Buffalo Bill. Buffalo Bill or Buffalo Bob?
I mean, Buffalo Bill would be the reference, but I like putting the little stutter in there, Buffalo Babil. Anyways. Godol is the one who's like, yeah, this Kuga's certainly different than the last one. And Baruba's like, the Linto have also changed a lot, as we get a quick shot out the window of effectively the riot team coming in full armor and high-powered rifles. We once again get a quick cut to Ichijo. There's also been some focus on a briefcase sitting next to him in the car. This will come into play, but at the moment it's just, they're making a point to show this to us.
Yeah. It's probably the U.S. Constitution. I've seen a Nicolas Cage movie before.
So we then cut to near Ikebukuro Station. Sakurai and Sugita are there, along with, you know, their battalion of cops. And Godai shows up, already transformed, to engage with Babel. And we get a good look at him, finally. And... he's interesting.
It's not a terrible costume.
It's the oxidized brass green again, but against the distinct brown of his body, it looks better than it did on Jayza last week.
Yeah, and the helmet actually gives some solid indication of what it is. Like, we picked out Buffalo, you know, from our guesses before Jed informed us. There were some we haven't been able to do that lately.
Yeah.
I like it.
Yeah.
Yeah, I do too.
It reads strength. It reads how it's supposed to. Like, it works.
The horns help break up the silhouette a little. The fur on the shoulders through the armor mesh gives a nice shaggy nod towards... Yeah, he's shaggy, but not like ultimate form Goma where the hair is.
We said shaggy, not hair metal.
And they fight. And Godai goes to do his mighty kick, which I for a moment forgot he was not in rising mighty form. I'm like, he's going to kill everybody.
You get a check for gold trim.
You're skipping the awesome jump kick.
Oh, yes, you're right. Because this fight starts off with just punches. And this is when Babel's like, oh, you punch a lot harder than the old Kuga. It'd be interesting to see what kind of game you could play.
Mm-hmm. And he's like, I'm going to be the harbinger of ultimate darkness, and picks up his spiky brass knuckles and knocks a hole in Kuga's chest. We forgot about that bit.
Yeah, he does. Because we see the armor powders.
Mm-hmm.
Godai goes to do a kick, and Babel grabs his foot, and we get a great jump kick to the head. It's such a good move, and yeah, I'm so sorry, audience, that I skipped over that. I had to get to the, he's going to kill people. Oh, wait, no, it's not rising form. It's okay.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But then I was like, is Babel going to go down to like a chump to regular mighty kick?
Negative.
No. The symbol forms on his chest, and he literally just flexes it away while saying he will be the harbinger of ultimate darkness, and he shifts into his Herculean form. And it's a nice little improvement. I like the spikes that come out of his shoulders and stuff like that.
This is the Warhammer I was looking for last episode.
And then, yeah, he grabs one of the little dangly bits off his chest armor, and it turns into a spiked Warhammer.
A spiked two-handed meat tenderizer.
And he proceeds to wail on Godai.
Yeah, he whoops the monkey shit out of him.
Godai switches to Titan form after he effectively has his arm broken. Because, oh yeah, maybe I should have gone to the durable form first. And for the first time, and as of this moment only time in the series, we see Titan form take damage.
Oh yeah. Like those spikes on the meat mallet just perforate. There is a perfect set of circular indentation for the hammerhead itself, and then every spike is outlined.
It looks like a larger version of a, what's it called in Koimig? A beveling planisher.
God damn it. That's the secret right there. Godai needed to bring a Franklinator.
Producer's note. If you don't understand this reference, I can't help you because neither do I.
Chipmunk on a stick. But no, it's not even like it's one hit. Every single strike is denting the armor.
And he goes down and... There's literally no reason for Babel to not kill Godai in this moment until a shot rings out.
Yeah.
Ichijo's ultimate is off cooldown. So he uses it, and this shot takes it out of Babel. He starts shaking. He collapses to the ground and falls down the stairs.
Yeah, they shot him full of squid tranquilizer.
While this fight has been going on, by the way, forgot to mention, the Goram shows up and merges with the Beat Chaser and is just sort of hanging out there.
I love that it's become just its own little entity. Just like, hey, if you need to drive somebody out of the city, I'm over here. You know where you parked me. It's all good.
And Godai gets up, gets on the Goram at this point, switches into Mighty Form, and takes Babel for a ride.
Yep.
Oh, shit. Here we go again.
Yep.
Yeah.
As he drives off into the countryside, he thanks Ichijo for the help. And Ichijo looks like he's about to go after him for a moment, and then he's overcome by some sort of psychic attack, effectively. And we get a brief glimpse. Dagova's nearby.
It's either that or the guy from the Clear Eyes commercial. Because you just see a big old red eyeball.
Fair enough.
Looks like he used some eye drops.
At a train station, Mika. Remember Mika?
No. And I will continue to not remember Mika.
It's fine. The first child who morosely walked around the city.
They all blur together after a while.
It's true. Anyways, she's sitting there, and there's an announcement made that due to ULF attack that the trains are being suspended for the time being. Thank you for your patience and understanding. We cut to the Saitama Prefecture, and Ichijo is chasing after Godai. Ask Godai, hey, you sure about this? And Godai's like, yeah, Inukita has the idea that if I switch into gold trim while on the bike will also get gold trim. And who are we to say she's wrong?
Nobody, because that's exactly what happens. They show up at the abandoned quarry because the abandoned warehouse district was booked this week.
Another series had it. Presumably, the Kamen Rider and the Sentais traded. God, I would love it if whatever Sentai episode aired this week happened to have a scene at a factory. That would be great.
That would be hilarious.
Producer's note, while it's been a bit since I watched Time Ranger, unfortunately, I'm pretty sure it did not feature a factory this week.
So Babel finally gets thrown off of the bike. Godai goes into rising form, and sure enough, the bike gets gold trim too. And we get the first, and potentially only, Beat Goram attack.
It's pretty cool.
It looks essentially just like the Trigoram attack, but it's clearly stronger.
I really wanted the Buffalo Man to, like, charge and then to have just, like, a
clash into each other and maybe a bit of a struggle before he's finally knocked back and the symbol appears.
Yeah, I didn't have to say any of that. Thank you.
That would have been cool.
It would have been very cool.
That's not what happens.
Nope. The buffalo gets billy goat rammed and then explodes in a mile-high conflagration?
Vortex? Like, truly fire tornado.
Yeah, just like a pillar of fire that can be seen from mountains away, because that's where our camera pans back to.
I want to know how the Beat Goram attack is able to funnel the blast upwards versus Godai's rising, which sends it out.
Diesel. Yeah, it runs on diesel instead of gasoline.
I don't have a good counter to that, so sure.
That's how I get away with everything.
It is the Monster Mash.
I think this is the earliest we have done a Monster Mash into an episode.
Speaking of getting away with stuff, Jenny, what you feeling?
He looks like he smells of cigarettes and regret. Also cow. I don't know, there's nothing here. Pass.
You don't want to fuck somebody who smells like a wet sheep?
No.
Yeah, he does look like he has a musk, and I don't mean that in, like, a positive context.
No, in the, have you ever showered?
Somebody hung up that bearskin rug wet for a year.
Agarongi's dead. We're halfway through the first episode of this 2 episodes, and our Grungy's dead.
God, if they hit us with a human interest story at this hour, I'm going to lose it. Stop typing. It concerns me.
Alas, poor Yorick.
But we didn't know him well. In fact, we hardly knew him, which that brings us to this week's Tropusatsu.
Ah, yes.
We hardly knew ye. This trope takes its name from the Irish folk song Johnny, We Hardly Knew Ye.
Ah, yes. One of my favorites, reprised by the Dropkick Murphys.
Yes. So this is obviously a trope for when a character leaves a story almost as soon as they are introduced. It's particularly common in serialized media. Death will be typically the most common way that this happens, but not always. Sometimes, you know, oh, this character's introduced and maybe they're going to be important and then they get on a plane to New York and we just don't see them again.
Yeah. There's a lot of examples of this. Basically anything that's serialized with an antagonist per episode, we're going to see this pop up.
Doesn't even have to be antagonists. It could be like who we think are important side characters and then the story continues on and they're just not there anymore.
Yeah.
It's worth remembering here that Babel was introduced like 4-ish episodes ago and he and Jaza were both brought up to be like, oh, these are under Gadol, the strongest of the go.
So he was introduced 4 episodes ago? It was funny, zoomy. I'm sorry for all these bod jokes. Like chocolate
silence. And Babel has done something that no other Garongi has done. He didn't even make it halfway through the first episode of what should have been his 2-episode storyline.
Yeah.
Sure, his Herculean form looked cool. He managed to hurt Titan form. But what is the point of him? He did nothing.
Yeah.
even Megadrada, our stupid Sasquatch tiger mask,
oh, yeah,
made it to the end of his own episode.
That's crazy.
We still have the rest of this episode and one more to go, and there are no more go, except for Godol.
Damn. Hmm.
Yeah. So we cut to the research institute, and hey, there's a familiar face on the slab. Tsubaki is autopsying Goma, and he sees something inside the carcass and is like, well, that confirms it.
Yeah, it was appendicitis.
Inokita comes in. They exchange pleasantries, and there's a brief discussion about, you know, the research they've been doing, and phone call comes from Ichijo and Godai, and Ichijo thanks Inokita for the new war crimes that she sent him, and we're informed that it was a tranquilizer bullet.
Sweet God. The amount of horse trank they just hit this go with to disable, like, she makes a note. With everything we put into that, it's astounding that it only slowed him down as short amount of time as it did.
Because the fact that she refers to it as tranquilizer, like, what were you expecting to happen? Him to just drop down comatose?
Yeah, we were hoping to dissect that one alive.
Oh God, vivisect the Gorongi?
Well, hell yeah. How else are we going to get the magic crystals in their belt buckles to work?
Yeah, I don't know.
Yeah.
Maybe that.
Science, Jared, science.
But Ichijo says that they're going to be late for their meeting. Inokita says that's fine, take their time. And we linger a bit longer with Ichijo and Godai on the bridge. You know, this would be the perfect time for them to have, like, a romantic picnic, but that's not what happens.
No.
We cut to Popol, and Nana is making coffee and Pops is scrapbooking.
We have another hair choice.
Yeah, it's not as bad as the first one, but it's still a choice.
I get the feeling like the hair and costume people are just messing with her hair and outfit just consistently, just to see what they can get away with. Like, it's a running joke.
Did you see the little braids?
Both of them.
No, I missed that on the poofs.
Yeah, those weren't like strings coming over her shoulders. They were like individual tiny pigtails from the very corners of the back of her neck.
Oh, I don't like that at all.
Neither did we.
I'm glad I didn't notice that, and I'm pissed that I'm going to the next time I see her.
You know what, Jared? Maybe you did, and your brain tried to protect you by blocking it out immediately.
Is that why I smell toast?
Anybody else taste pancakes?
No, I made toast earlier. You're good.
Oh, thank you. I was worried for a moment. Pops brings up to Nana that, you know, shouldn't let what happened last week get her down. She should try an audition again. And Nana informs Pops that, in fact, she has already set up an audition.
Hell yeah.
And before we get any more details, the phone rings and Nana goes and answers it. And it's Mika. But Mika's like, hey, I'm going to be late getting into town because of the ULF attack. May not be able to hang out as much as I wanted to. And Nana's like, no, that's fine. Well, just however much time you can spend, happy to see you. When did they establish they had this sort of friendship? I mean, I guess there was Mika sending the letter?
Yeah, I didn't get weekend hangouts from that at all. Like, I don't know.
From there, we cut to the inside of an apartment in the Itogawa ward.
Yeah, this scene feels like it was taken straight out of X-Files. Like, this is some serial killer behavior.
And there's just some guy throwing darts at the same advertisement for the flute recital that Mika's going to.
Mm-hmm.
He seems to be aiming for the picture of the guy in the corner of the poster, who the subtitles tell us is the 12th director.
Yeah.
I guess this man has slighted him at some point. He puts on his hat. He starts loading up a bag with stuff. And yeah, it kind of looks like he has like a paper bag handgun.
Yeah. I also love that the show notes have him listed as some guy.
On a bridge, we get to Baruba and Godol just talking again, and Godol saying, well, everyone else has failed, but damn it, I'm not going to. And Baruba being like, are you sure? Because everyone before you has failed. I get that you're the leader of the go, Mr. Epaulettes. But are you sure you're that much better?
We spent 30% of our monster costume budget on his armor. He's got a decent shot.
He says he has an idea.
Fair. We'll have to see how that plays out. But given that he's not the big bad, Daguva is, odds aren't looking great for Beetleborg.
God damn it, not you too.
I'll still refer to him by his actual name, but tell me in his monster form he does not look like a somewhat more organic Beetleborg.
Yeah, modern major Beetleborg.
So at the Research Institute, we've got Godai, Ichijo, Sakurako, Tsubaki, and Jean all sitting around a table.
The team's all here, and also Jean.
Jean has stepped up because he's a suit jacket. He's in just as formal of attire as everyone else.
It's good to see him healing.
Everyone but Godai.
I would not want to see Godai in a suit jacket. I would be concerned.
Nah, I'd be watching like a tiger in overalls. It just doesn't make any sense. See?
It doesn't make sense. You're right. And they're discussing Tsubaki's, as we find out, month-long autopsying of dead Gorongi.
He's been having a blast.
And that his findings are that biologically they're identical to humans, except for a stone in their tummies.
So this makes
they're
me...
They're troll dolls.
Oh, no. See, this makes me wonder if the Gorongi are actually not an independent species, but more like a parasitic organism, you know, symbiote style.
Venom, but troll dolls, because it's a crystal. I don't think I can take them seriously anymore with that mental image in mind.
Yeah.
But Tsubaki confirms that not only do they have this stone in their abdomens, but that it has a full nervous system branching off from it into their bodies. And he and Inokita have extrapolated that it is this stone that allows them to shift into their monster forms and gives them their combat abilities. We're shown a side-by-side MRI of Goma's abdomen and Godai's abdomen. And other than, like, the outline of the belt in Godai's, things look shockingly identical.
Mm-hmm.
And Tsubaki even brings us up that it's exactly identical. And so there is concern that they're a biological weapon, and they choose to bring up at this point how Baruba said that Godai could be another Daguva. And they go, didn't you say Daguva is supposed to be the herald of ultimate darkness?
Yeah, the harbinger of all darkness, yes.
So you're saying Godai could be that too. And Godai's like, no, it's okay, I'm fine.
And for once, it doesn't move anybody.
Sakurako quickly jumps in, though, and she brings up that from what she can tell, and Jean then proceeds to back her up on this, that the Goram seems to have the same kind of Amidam as Godai does, and that when Godai calls the Goram, it is this stone that seems to activate and power it, and it is thought that the Amidam responds to the will of the user. And therefore, as long as Godai doesn't want to become the ultimate darkness, he won't.
Hmm. That's not concerning.
And Godai's like, yep, no desire at all to be the harbinger of ultimate darkness. Everything's going to be fine. And he gives a thumbs up, and Sakurako gives a thumbs up, and Jean gives a thumbs up, and Ichijo gives a thumbs up. Even Inokita does.
Tsubaki gets straight peer pressured into it. He's still not on board.
He doesn't give the thumbs up. He just says, well, you need to do something to take care of Daguva.
Yeah.
And we then cut outside the building, and Godai and Ichijo are walking out together, and Godai's like, you know, this was kind of nice. It didn't even feel like a meeting. It was just like hanging out with friends.
Yes, because my get-togethers with friends often involve talks of one of becoming a killing machine.
We haven't had hangouts like that since we stopped playing Risk as a group.
It's true. Those were dark times.
I feel safer now that we don't play Risk as a group.
I do too.
You only need one knife pull to stop.
Yep. Haven't touched the game since.
It's an intense-ass board game.
Godai takes off. Ichijo hangs a bit longer and is like, oh, get together with friends. I've never had one of those before.
Dull.
And from there we cut to the Arakawa building, and Mika is walking up. This is clearly where this flute recital that she is a part of is happening. And as she's walking towards it, the gray hat guy gets out of a van and goes to the back and gets out a cart of some stuff, and he loads the paper bag handgun in, and it really reads like he's going to kill her.
Yeah, dude, his whole process felt like a Die Hard goon reject sequence. So he's dressed as a janitor, he has a little janitor cart, and then he's got this nice leather handbag full of presumably paper bag gun. It had the right amount of camp. This guy's thought this plan out, whatever it is.
And right as Mika gets to the door and is about to go in, she turns and, like, makes eye contact with this guy. And that's where the episode ends.
Yeah, never make contact with the stabby guy, Jared.
Yeah, I know. This is a weird spot to be in.
Yeah, I've got questions about my level of investment from here on out, because I have a sneaking suspicion that we're going to have a human interest story. And, man, we could have made the goat last longer.
How about we just go ahead and watch it?
I don't think we have a choice.
That's true. We are contractually obligated.
We will be continuing this Mika and Nana side story quest against the advice of medical professionals.
I don't think it's side story. This seems A-plot.
I refuse to acknowledge it as such.
Fair.
No fear, no pain.
Huh.
I didn't expect to spend a whole second episode watching a sad child get sadder.
Yeah. Let's take it from the top and then we'll get into our thoughts on it.
If you insist.
So the episode starts right where we left off last episode. We see Mika walking towards the door, this random guy posing as a cleaner, chasing after her. She turns around, makes eye contact with him, and he grabs something off the cart and holds out his hand. And oh, it's her shell necklace.
Oh, nice of him.
He gives it back to her, and she goes in the building. He does too. Opening credits.
You know, the most compelling part of this episode was pretty much the opening credits. I jest.
We cut to Ichijo driving. He is passing by some shops, and he sees a flower shop. And he stops, and he gets out, and he goes and possibly for the first time in his life, buys flowers.
He damn sure hasn't bought them for his mom.
Nope. Gets back in the car, continues driving, and we get a quick shot of police headquarters, and Nozomi's there, and she's on the radio with Ichijo. And he says, as long as nothing else is happening, he's going to this flute competition. And Nozomi's like, let Mika know that the entire police force is rooting for her, and we're not going to stop until ULF Zero is dealt with.
Somehow those are related concepts for her.
Yes. How bizarre. We then cut to the preschool. Godai has just pulled up, and he's witnessing Minori and a bunch of the other children attempting to perform a banishing ritual on another small child. Only Godai's appearance interrupts it, and once again the Muppets swarm and devour him.
Damn it. One more summoning ritual for the box Oni foibled by Godai's sudden appearance. He's this close to being real, Jared.
They're so happy to see him. He's so happy to see them as he is consumed.
Yes.
We cut to the police institute, and Sakurako, Tsubaki, Inokita, and Jean are walking out of the conference room as if they are the best of friends. It was kind of weird, actually.
Oh, Godai and Ichijo are off having their main plot, so these guys have to have their own little contained bottle adventure.
And they go and they check on one of Inokita's assistants, and they see the Gorams. They're like, oh, it came back on its own and in one piece this time. And Inokita's like, oh, I guess the liquid metal coating we put on the beat chaser must work. And she cuts off mid-sentence and asks, did the Goram come back looking like this? The assistant's like, well, yeah, it did. Something's different about it, but I'm going to be honest with you. Other than the fact that the colors were kind of muted, I don't know what it was.
It did look like it was darker, almost like it was dull. We've seen, you know, some very bright metallic and chrome on this thing. It looked almost like, I don't know how to describe it. It literally turns
to stone when it crumbles. So, like, this feels minor in comparison.
It was gold after killing Bebel.
Did it still have, I guess, okay.
The front still did
the
have face the gold plate
is still
on it.
Gold.
So I guess this for her is validation that her theory was correct.
Because she does bring up, oh, he must have switched into gold trim while writing this to deal with ULF. What was it? She said 47? I think. Babel. Who cares? He's been dead since last episode.
We've already moved on.
Tsubaki asks some questions that do somewhat boil down to, hey, so do you think I can dissect this thing? This time, it's not serial killer. It's just his need to autopsy things.
Maybe that's what we've been misreading, Jared. And Jetty, we apologize. It might not be that he wants to kill people. He might just like cutting things up. You know, like Barry the Chopper.
I'm so tired.
Somehow this did not make him feel better.
No, weird.
I'm confused.
Attempted comfort have fallen flat.
We cut to Chiba City, and Ichijo has arrived at the concert hall. Inside the concert hall, Mika is walking in. We get, real quick, a beautiful establishing shot of a pipe organ that we're just not going to get to hear play. And she's walking in the house and looks, and there's a bunch of seats that are reserved. We see one labeled for President Arakawa.
Speaking of President Arakawa,
he's in a bathroom stall getting punched in the stomach by the random guy in gray until he passes out. And then the guy in gray hastily puts some packing tape over his mouth.
With cloth gloves. It's not going to stick very well at all. This guy's a total amateur.
I mean, at least he knows not to leave fingerprints anywhere.
True, true.
We cut back to the preschool and get a really touching moment of Godai leading a sing-along for the kids while Minori plays the piano.
I was strangely invested in the Japanese nursery rhyme they were singing.
Yeah, it's about dandelions and also, like, life?
Mm-hmm.
It was charming. The English translation's not perfect, I suppose. You certainly couldn't get the cadence right. It almost had the same feel as, like, Twinkle Twinkle Little Star, but the music wasn't quite the same, just close.
Yeah, but same, like, vibe.
Yeah. And we see that Shudo seems to have cut the rat tail off.
No, Nana stole it. She stole it and added to her growing collection of rat tails coming out of the sides of her head.
Either way, he is no longer a delinquent.
Nah, I have faith in him. He's just Philip now.
Inside the Arakawa building, Ichijo has now come inside, and he's noticing that there seems to be a lot of police work going on, and he comes up to Detective Katsuragi, who he has worked with in the past. We find out. They exchange pleasantries. Katsuragi's even like, well, here's the real case. You? Flowers?
Cop humor.
Did you finally get a girlfriend? No, that's not how this works. He likes
boys. No, sir, these are for a child.
Yes, he's like, these are for a child. I met her doing a case that I'm on. Just wanted to try and show some support. She's had a hard time of things. Katsuragi talks with him some more. We cut back to the preschool. Godai is saying goodbye to Minori and the kids. As he goes to leave, we see that there's these two, like, I don't know if they're paper mache or concrete, but they're rabbits outside, and they look like they are somehow tied to the box Oni.
I love the subtle growing mythology of the box Oni who haunts this kindergarten.
Much like the Muppet AU, this is our contribution to Kuga.
Correct.
I cut to an elevator, and the guys got President Arakawa. They're going up towards the roof.
For a reason.
Yeah, we then cut to Ichijo and Katsuragi again, and they're discussing that President Katsuragi was supposed to give the opening speech. He's gone missing. They're looking for him. He recently laid off a bunch of people, and that maybe that's causing hostilities. They head towards a meeting room, and Ichijo's like, well, you know, whatever I can do, I'll certainly help. And Katsuragi's like, you're here to see a little girl, as far as I understand it. Why don't you go do that, lest she get worried? But hey, when things go south, jump in and save us.
Yeah, you're definitely going to have to do all the real police work here. We both know it.
We cut to Polpol, and Nana and Pops are there, talking. And Nana has a brief discussion with Pops about how, despite everything that's happened, the fact that Mika is competing in this flute thing makes her feel like, you know, she needs to do her best as well. And Pops is like, that's great. I'll make you some of my famous May curry. And Nana gets mean and tells Pops that she wants something edible.
Which, damn.
Oh, no, she didn't!
Pops is wounded by this.
Yeah, you can't eat my food, but we can't take you in public with that mop on your head. Calm down.
I hate that I saw it. That hairstyle is terrible.
Yeah, the double rat tail. You thought it couldn't get worse.
Is that considered like a rat king tail? Don't know. Thankfully, we get Baruba and Doldo to save us from this.
Yeah, we cut away and I don't think we go back.
Not to Pol-Pol. But there's also a really weird filter. Like, in close-up, Baruba just looks like a fucking zombie. And then Gadol looks equally horrendously sunburned and also, like, blue?
Yeah. It just washes all the color out of their faces and makes them look just sallow and bleached out.
It's awful. But Baruba holds up the ring, saying to Gadol, "You ready?" He tosses his conditions to Doldo. But then also says he's not ready, that Kuga has inspired him to try something different.
I'd still insist he's going to come out with a clothing line with his own brand.
And Baruba seems amused by this because she just lets him walk away and muses to herself, oh, something different, huh? Let's see. Back in the Arakawa building, Ichijo has made his way back downstairs into the lobby and Mika happens to be there. And they exchange pleasantries. He gives her the flowers. She tells him that she's feeling nervous about this competition, which is totally understandable.
Producer's note. We got a bit out of order here. The scene with the Garanji goes here. Our bad.
Then we cut back, and they're now sitting in, like, a hallway. And presumably this conversation is meant cheer Mika up? But I can't fathom how Ichijo thought this was going to happen, because Ichijo is talking to her about Daguva killing the other Garongi.
Yeah, it's like this little girl has told you she's nervous, she's about to go on stage for a competition of playing her instrument, and your advice on how to calm her down is, you know them monsters? What have been killing people all around you for months now?
The one that killed your father specifically?
Yeah.
He's still on the loose.
Yeah, we haven't caught him, and he started killing more things besides just us, and we don't have any explanation for that. Go get him, champ. It's the weirdest motivational speech tactic I've ever seen in my life. He does not have Godai's instinct for these things at all.
It maybe almost works, because she's like, so does that mean that there aren't many left, and maybe at some point there won't be any? And he's like, well, yeah, hypothetically.
That's not what I implied at all, but sure, run with that thought.
Oh, this is how I save that.
Excellent.
The boys were too busy trying to be funny for the running commentary to pick up what is an important moment for the episode. Mika gives Ichijo some buns with red bean paste, and they discover they both eat it in the same unusual way. Ichijo smiles, and they talk about how Mika has a serious impression of him.
Godai is driving down the road on the beat chaser when suddenly he is psychically assaulted once again by Daguva. He stops, looks around, thinks he spotted him, jumps midair Henshins into dragon form so that the leap can go even farther, lands on top of a building.
That's definitely how physics work.
In this show. He looks around, feels Daguva's presence is there, but can't see it. So he switches to Pegasus form. And while this seemed like a good idea at the time, it was not.
He turned white with fear.
Yes.
Like, literally.
Godai is so overwhelmed once he focuses in on where Daguva is that he switches to growing form and collapses to the ground. And when he demorphs, he is soaked in sweat and gasping for breath.
He got scared shitless. Which bodes ill. I don't think we're quite up to this challenge yet.
Back at the Arakawa building, we finally see Mika performing. And there's not really anything to say about that, just she does a flute performance.
She toot toot on the flute. It was pretty good.
And then we cut to the top of the building, and the cops happen to have found the random guy. And holding the president hostage Does he want his job back? Does he want to kill this?
Ostensibly, he was trying to kill him because, like, he's sitting there in his apartment throwing darts at his head. He's got this plan, but...
We learn his name, but it's not important.
Nope.
It will never be said again.
We do find out that, yes, he was one of these people who was let go during the layoffs. So, yeah, I guess he wants revenge. He has not thought this through.
No.
He's cornered on the top of this building. The cops are keeping a distance because he has a gun. Great fire discipline on Ichijo's part.
Yeah, and then later when he has to actually, like, wrestle the guy to the ground, he's got the gun held in his palm where nothing can accidentally hit the trigger. Like, it's did some homework on that, for
yes.
sure.
Yes. It's like they're trying to talk, sort of. But there's no real, like, hostage negotiation going on. They're like, hey, we're here for you. Don't need to do anything hasty. Just talk to us. What is it you're looking for? None of that. Just like a, hey, let him go. No, I'm going to kill him. And he trips for a moment, trying to back away from the cops. They use that as their opportunity to move forward. He regains his composure and he shoots one of the cops in the leg. He clearly has no plan. This turns into a bit of a chase towards the building. He finally shoves the president away and just bolts into an elevator, heading towards the ground floor. Ichijo decides he's going to take the stairs, and you know what? He arrives at the same time.
He's very good at stairs, Jared.
He parkours the last little bit and chases after this guy, and they run out into the front of the building. And wouldn't you know it, it's right as Mika has come out, and she's just sort of holding her flute and looking like a scared child because she is 10 and here without any sort of adult.
Yeah, that's valid. It's time to re-traumatize this child. She'd almost recovered.
So this guy, you know, who was kind enough to return her shells to her not a couple hours ago, suddenly comes barreling through, knocks a woman to the ground, and then picks her up, threatening to kill her. Ichijo comes chasing after, he's gun pointed, he's ready. Takes aim, and he waits for his moment as this guy and the woman struggle, and finally Ichijo sees his shot, and he shoots the gun out of the guy's hand, and runs over, and tackles him, and puts him in an armbar.
Yeah, if I learned anything from Tommy Lee Jones, it's that shooting a gun out of somebody's hand is really challenging.
Mika has once again been traumatized by this. Ichijo holds the guy in the armbar until the other cops show up, passes him to them. They handcuff him. His hand's in front of him, which, okay, sure.
Hey, different police, different SOPs.
It's safer to, I think, at least it's safer to cuff him behind their back, but sure. I'm not a cop. I don't know. And Godai happens to show up right at this moment.
There's a part of me that wanted this episode to end with him in Kuga form, just whooping the monkey shit out of a regular dude. Just like those few comics where you see Superman show up and, like, just grab a purse snatcher by the collar and being like, are you done, buddy?
That could have been entertaining.
Mm-hmm.
Ichijo asks Godai to take care of Mika as he has accrued a considerable amount of paperwork. And he seems in a real hurry because he runs off to go do this paperwork.
Yeah, if they don't make it as a couple, it will be because Ichijo is emotionally closed off enough to foist emotional responsibilities for them as a couple off onto Godai. And that can be a heavy burden, you know?
It is worth bringing up before Ichijo runs off. Katsuragi comes back out and is like, oh man, you were great. You did everything for us. And hey, once the ULFs are done, there's still going to be people like this for you to deal with. Your job's never done.
I love the just wheezing in of the people have been the real monsters the whole time and will continue to be so. You have job security even when real monsters don't exist.
All, of course, said in front of the traumatized child. You're not helping. Godai takes Mika back to the train station, and she's discussing that she cannot wrap her head around how happy, smiley Ichijo and on the job Ichijo can be the same person. She said, you know, it's like he was someone else entirely. And Godai says, no, that's the real him, but so was the smiley part.
And then the trust issues begin.
The idea there is supposed to be people are complex and can be more than one thing at a time. These two seemingly opposite things can in fact both be true, but trying to explain the nuance of that to a 10-year-old, yes, all that does is breed trust issues.
Oh yeah, for sure. She now just thinks any adult that's nice to her is also probably violent.
How do you tell the difference?
You wait for the violence.
I think this might be the first time that this show has tackled a morally gray sort of subject matter. Not really a thing preteens should be dealing with, but more adults, and it falls flat on its face. Because I don't think the message they were trying to convey is the one that they actually did.
Yeah, no.
That's the end of the episode.
Cool.
Let's start with the episode.
Sure.
What do we want to pick as our thing?
Flutes.
Flutes.
Flutes, yeah. Is easy.
Okay.
Jetty, you want to go first? I am interested to hear your opinion on these episodes.
For the most part, this isn't really a Kuga episode. It's mostly a cop drama after the first 10 minutes of the first episode. But it's not a bad cop drama. It serves as chance for a Shijo to show off and look cool, and I appreciate that. It does tie back to the discussion of violence and escalation, so it's not completely detached. Overall, I think a 3.5. The technical aspects are really solid here. The music in the initial chase sequence really gets your blood pumping. Mighty's armor just denting, and Titan form not faring much better were some nice practical effects. I don't know what it is, but I really like the head-on shot of Go Die on the beat Gorum. But that filter 3 out of 5. We have a decent length fight with some good choreography. When Babel catches Kuga's fist and then Kuga kick was a really cool moment. And each time that hammer hits you feel the impact. I love it. That finisher should have been awesome, but it felt more like an obligation they had to get out of the way before the final couple fights. Still gets a 4. That's 3.5 flutes.
I'll go second just because I want to get my vitriol out of the way and be done and be able to put away my soapbox. So we didn't have much in the way of fights, I'll start there. But what we did have was incredible. This is exactly what I wanted from a strength-based counter to Kuga. We were literally talking last week about when the shark lady switched into a Herculean form and had a broadside, how cool would it be if she'd had a giant warhammer and gone at Kuga with that? And we got that. These episodes started very, very bright for me with this fight scene. We got to see Titan form taken apart, and Godai had to be saved by Ichijo's rifle using new technology. So these fights definitely challenged Kuga. We got to see a type of combatant that we haven't seen too much of, the heavy offensive brawler type. The fight scenes with him were very, very cool. For that reason, fights get a 3. There wasn't anything else the rest of the time. We got to watch Ichijo arm wrestle a dude to get him to the ground and some chasing. Cinematography, I'm going to give it a 2. There just wasn't anything there. There was one cool special effect. I won't even say cool because how it was used. When Ichijo is chasing random dude number 4 as he runs out of the building to grab a hostage, there was like a fisheye lens that they did in one part, but it wasn't an important thing, so it was just out of place. We didn't have any bad CGI, but we also just didn't really have any CGI. There's a nothing burger here. So 2 on cinematography, and plot gets a 1. And I feel like the 1 is generous because of the cool thing we got with Godai going after Dagova and literally turning up his perception and getting scared so hard he drops completely out of his forms. That was intense. That was cool. That was very cool. But we had 45 minutes of side plot about Mika and a dude that's disgruntled after being fired, and it did nothing for me. And that's sad for me because we really did start off with Buffalo Bill fight and that lead-in really cool. I don't have a problem when we jump into the middle of a Go or one of the Grongies game. I even said when we were watching the episode, it felt almost like a dream sequence. Like, is this really happening already? We're 5 minutes in, and then it was just done and gone. You're right, Jed. It wasn't a Kuga episode, and I didn't care about the cop drama. That's not what I'm here for. So, all in all, that gives me a 2.
So I guess I'll start with plot. And it is always interesting when Kuga chooses to start in media res. Once again, I find myself in this awkward spot, same as last week, where I wish they had actually shown me the game, because this seemed more interesting. And yet the last time they genuinely showed us the game, I didn't care. I feel so weird about this. Babel could have, should have been a more interesting focal point. This is the last of the go before we get to Godol. And while there have been these human moments, Kuga as a whole has been Godai versus the Gurungi. And when we have had these sort of other focused stories, they've been more side plots. They haven't taken the focus like this. And for it to happen this late in the series, it feels jarring. I get to an extent we have had to build up this idea of, is everything okay with Godai? The potential to fall to darkness, the escalation of violence that all of this has had to build to. But something like this about the nature of man, and that it should have been somewhere in the middle, this close to the end, it feels out of place. And it's not what I'm wanting. So I think plot is a 2. Cinematography, I'm gonna give a 3-2. Yeah, the shot of Kuga on the Goram was cool. The practical effects, I loved seeing Godai's armor get taken apart. But then we got that weird filter with the Go, and that might have been the worst shot. Because that wasn't like, oh, this CG did not age well. This was a lighting, and it... ugh.
Could see every pore on Baruba's face.
She looked monstrous in like a Walking Dead sort of way. Yeah, these things just sort of balance out to a bog standard 3. Combat, it was short. I wanted more, but I loved what we got.
That was actually one of the longest continuous fight scenes we've had in the show.
Maybe because it was so front-loaded, it felt shorter.
Mm-hmm.
The practical effects, like I have stated before, any time Kuga's armor gets damaged, it gets bonus points. And to see not only Mighty Kuga's armor vaporize on a punch, but to see the damage done to Titan, something that we have not seen up to this point, that was great. But when you go from that, even with the amazing attention to detail of like Ichijo properly holding the gun while doing an armbar to ensure that it does not go off, you can't compare them. They're two totally different things. But all in all, what I'm looking at as far as combat, I thought was great. And so I think that warrants a 4. So with a 2, a 3, and a 4, that gives me 3 flutes.
So overall, that gives us an episode score of 2.833 repeating flutes. I guess over to Buffalo Bob. Jed, take us away.
I guess leather comes from cows. Cows are sort of like buffalo. It's honestly more than we've gotten with the last 3 go in human form. As for Babel's monster form, I actually really like it. The brown and green give good color. He has a lot of texture with the fur and chainmail. The head sculpt is basically just a miniature buffalo head. The Herculean form doesn't change much, only getting shoulder spikes. But the base was such a good start, I don't mind. Bonus points for Hammer. I'm gonna give him a 4. Unfortunately, that's where his good points stop. Outside of generic arrogance, he's not around long enough to have any behavior of note. 1 out of 5. I thought it was a bull in a china shop, not a buffalo. Sealing people in subway stations is new, but otherwise this is just another rampage. Points for giant numbers, but pretty bland all things considered. Another one. That comes to a composite score of 2 flutes from me. They wasted that design.
Oof. I'm not going to come along and help the case too much here. I'm going to start with his design and aesthetic. I really like the use of color. We have to kind of glaze over the Shadow Wolf caricaturized aesthetic in the human form. It was the year 2000. Sensibilities were a little bit different. You could get away with some stuff that you can't get away with today. That doesn't excuse it. It just explains it. But I did think it did a very good job tonally of teleporting us to where they meant. Like, he was a bad character of Native American. We have a buffalo. We got there. We understood. The monster form, very, very cool. We've got the shaggy fur. We've got the horns with the correct curve to them to be buffalo horns. The low eyes on the face with the slit arounds. It felt right. This is an adherence to the animal nod that we haven't gotten from some of our go lately, and I appreciated it. With so many misses, it's nice to see a good hit. The hammer, awesome affectation. So for design, I'm actually going to go with a 4. Plan, I'm going to rank this higher than I instinctively feel I should based on the fact that we don't actually know what he was doing for the raw efficiency. This guy struck 4 times and killed 682 people, so by the time it was time for his 5th hit, he needed 47 to be done. So clearly whatever he's doing is A, effective. We get to see some of the nods, and then Kuga just catches up with him and ends it. You know, it's something we haven't seen before. I did like how we jumped into the middle of this pursuit, but it didn't pay off. Jalaji's, we kind of jumped into the middle of his story, and we were catching up on the horrors that our characters were undergoing, and that got us emotionally invested. This didn't, and that almost worked for me in a different way, because just the callous disregard of this being business as usual, he's punching a time card, that belligerent stubbornness. So I'm actually going to go with a 3-5 for plan, just for efficiency. Personality, I unfortunately have to go with a 2, just because of the amount of personality we got from him. You're absolutely correct, we just didn't have a whole lot to work with. He does tick off a 1. He rises from that. We see something here that we haven't seen too often. Him taunting Kuga by saying, I wonder what your game would look like. Putting it right there in his face. You're one step off from being me. I like that. That's a different kind of threat to Kuga. It's a psychological. That coming from the character that's also just wailing the crap out of him with a mallet in his bare hands. It worked for me. So a 4, a 3, 5, and a 2 for personality averages me out to 3.166 repeating flutes.
I too will start with design, just sort of piggybacking off what both of you have said. His human form does seem to tie into his monster form a bit better than a lot of the others have done, but still also sticks with the displaced from time that all go have in their human form. I like the monster form. The green accent, particularly the fact that it's like that tarnished brass green on the rich brown that the rest of the costume is, pops very nicely. The head sculpt is a miniature buffalo, but that still does something to change his silhouette. The strategic use of fur to make him shaggy, but not comically so, I think was a great touch. And yeah, Herculean form didn't add a lot. I liked that it changed the eye color as well as added the shoulder spikes, because at first it was hard to distinguish his eyes because they were just a slightly shinier brown than the brows. But when he switched forms and it was black against that, I thought that stood out more. And the hammer looked great. I like his design in both regards better than I liked Jayza's last week. So I think I'm going to keep this trend going, and for design, give him a 4. Methodology. It's efficient, and starting off in media res, it didn't work this time for me like it did with Jalaji. Because this, more than anything, this is the first time that I have felt like a Gorongi feels like an obligation to the show. And that's disappointing. Yes, he is efficient, like you said, but again, I wanted to see this, not just the aftermath and a few bodies on the floor and a escalator ramp caved in. You don't even have to show the full slaughter, but his first couple attacks and then cut to the aftermath. I can fill in the rest from there, but give me something. So like a 2, I think, for methodology. And then behavior. You know, it's funny, this doesn't speak well for him, but until you brought up the whole, oh, I wonder what your game would look like, I could not remember a single line of dialogue that he said in any of the episodes he had been in, including what we had just watched. From my point of view, until you reminded me of that bit, he didn't have a personality. To be that forgettable, a 1. So That gives me a 2.333 repeating flutes.
And that gives us a 2.499. So effectively as close to 2.5 so we can be without going over. 2.5 flutes for this episode. That's rough, boys.
Our new lowest go.
Which is sad because we had such a cool design on the cow.
But also, wasn't Jayza last week the lowest, and then Zalazu before that the lowest? We have 3 episodes in a row now crowned a new lowest Grongi.
Listen, they're lowering our expectations before we get to the cool shit, so it seems more impressive.
God, I hope so.
I think for me, it was the tonal whiplash of the stakes changing so radically, right? 680 people's a ton. That's our highest. And then we spend 3 times the amount of episode on the emotional fragility of a girl at a flute recital. You know, I get that we need the interpersonal stories, but we've definitely seen better examples of that in this show, and we've seen a lot of them. It felt almost like an insult to the rest of the great emotional growth we've seen in other characters.
Since Goma, this has felt like filler.
Mm-hmm.
And it is so bizarre to me that they would choose this far into the series to do filler. I don't understand. There's also all this other stuff from the beginning of the show that we never saw that could have been more interesting and relevant. The rats, Nazuma and Nazumo. If we had seen a Gorongi fail its game and blow up because of that, that would have added so much more to this. Or the original Goma Ray, him getting away, and what that does to Godai.
I get the feeling these two were not originally intended to be in the show. They were introduced separate from the rest of the Go, if you remember.
Yeah, they do feel wholeheartedly like an afterthought. It feels like they had a couple little things that they wanted to show off before we got to these last episodes, and just needed to put together a framework to do it.
This is purely speculation, but I think Ajito might have been taking longer than expected, or some other behind-the-scenes thing that caused them to need to pad for time.
Oh.
Maybe? That could explain why you come up with these characters and then don't at all focus on their game, when every other Gorongi up to this point that has been the focus. That could be an explanation. But like we have said in regards to a couple other things, explanation, not an excuse.
Yep. I, for one, am excited for what we still got to do. I know that Godel's not going to disappoint, and neither is Dagova, and we've had such a blasé run-up to it that it's got to be awesome when we get there.
I hope so, but I find myself, for once, in the position where I'm hesitant for what's to come.
Damn, they got you.
Yeah, like, I am hoping that these last 6 episodes of the series pull it back up to the heights that it was. I don't particularly like being this negative.
Oh, I don't either. I'm sitting here with negative comments about the show being like, I love this show. What are we doing?
Yeah, this has been a joy to watch.
And on that note.
So, as a reminder, next week we will be covering 3 episodes instead of 2. So join us for episodes 44, 45, and 46, Crisis, Archenemy, and Indomitable.
You can reach us by email at commentarytrack@gmail.com or on Twitter at commentarytrack. You can support us at patreon.com/thecommentarytrack. Our Patreon will resume Wednesday following this episode's release. In a couple weeks, you will be able to find our coverage of the bonus episode Good Job.
Very model of a modern major Beagle Boy. Oh god, I'd messed that up.
Fits in cadence.
I said Beagleborg.
It's just got floppy ears.